Strictly speaking, it was the sacrist he should have asked for, because the fabric of the church was the sacrist's responsibility, but cellarers as a class were more approachable. In the end, the prior would make the decision anyway. The novice directed him to the undercroft of one of the buildings around the courtyard. Tom went in through an open doorway, and Ellen and the children followed. They all paused inside the door to peer into the gloom. This building was newer and more soundly constructed than the church, Tom could tell at once. The air was dry and there was no smell of rot. Indeed, the mixed aromas of the stored food gave him painful stomach pangs, for he had not eaten in 2 days. As his eyes adjusted, he saw that the undercroft had a good flagstone floor, short thick pillars, and a tunnel-vaulted ceiling. A moment later he noticed a tall, bald man spooning salt from a barrel into a pot. "Are you the cellarer?" said Tom. But the man held up a hand for silence, and Tom saw that he was counting. They all waited in silence for him to finish. At last he said, 2 score and 19, 3 score, and put the spoon down. Tom said, "I'm Tom, Master Builder, and I'd like to rebuild your Northwest Tower. I'm Cuthbert, called Whitehead the Cellarer, and I'd like to see it done," the man replied. "But we'll have to ask Prior Philip. You'll have heard that we have a new prior?"
"Yes."
Cuthbert was the friendly sort of monk, Tom decided, worldly and easygoing. He would be happy to chat. "And the new man seems intent on improving the appearance of the monastery." Cuthbert nodded. "But he's not so keen on paying for it. Did you notice that all the work is being done by monks? He won't hire any workmen. Says the priory already has too many servants." That was bad news. "How do the monks feel about that?" Tom asked delicately. Cuthbert laughed, and his wrinkled face creased up even more. "You're a tactful man, Tom Builder. You're thinking that you don't often see monks working so hard. Well, the new prior's not forcing anyone, but he interprets the rule of St. Benedict in such a way that those who do physical labor may eat red meat and drink wine, whereas those who merely study and pray must live on salt fish and weak beer. He can show you an elaborate theoretical justification for it, too. But the upshot is that he has plenty of volunteers for the hard work, especially among the youngsters." Cuthbert did not seem disapproving, just bemused. Tom said, "But monks can't build stone walls, no matter how well they eat." As he spoke, he heard a baby cry. The sound tugged at his heartstrings. It took him a moment to realize how odd it was that there should be a baby in a monastery. "Well, ask the prior," Cuthbert was saying, but Tom hardly heard. It sounded like the cry of a very small baby, just a week or two old, and it was coming nearer. Tom caught Ellen's eye. She looked startled, too. Then there was a shadow in the door. Tom had a lump in his throat. A monk walked in, carrying the baby. Tom looked at its face. It was his child. Tom swallowed hard. The baby's face was red, its fists were clenched, and its mouth was open, showing toothless gums. Its cry was not the cry of pain or sickness, just a simple demand for food. It was the healthy, lusty yell of a normal baby, and Tom felt weak with relief to see his son looking so well. The monk carrying him was a cheerful-looking boy of about 20 years, with unruly hair and a big, rather stupid grin. Unlike most of the monks, he did not react to the presence of a woman. He smiled at everyone and then spoke to Cuthbert. "Jonathan needs more milk." Tom wanted to take the child in his arms. He tried to freeze his face so that his expression would not betray his emotions. He threw a furtive glance at the children. All they knew was that the abandoned baby had been found by a traveling priest. They did not even know that the priest had taken him to the little monastery in the forest. Now their faces showed nothing but mild curiosity. They had not connected this baby with the one they had left behind. Cuthbert picked up a ladle and a small jug and filled the jug from a bucket of milk. Ellen said to the young monk, "May I hold the baby?" She held out her arms, and the monk handed the child to her. Tom envied her. He longed to hold that tiny, hot bundle close to his heart. Ellen rocked the baby, and he was quiet for a moment. Cuthbert looked up and said, "Ah, Johnny Eightpence is a fair nursemaid, but he doesn't have the woman's touch." Ellen smiled at the boy. Why do they call you Johnny Eightpence? Cuthbert answered for him. Because he's only 8 pence to the shillin', he said, tapping the side of his head to indicate that Johnny was half-witted. But he seems to understand the needs of poor dumb creatures better than us wise folk. All part of God's wider purpose, I'm sure, he finished vaguely. Ellen had edged over to Tom, and now she held the baby out to him. She had read his thoughts. He gave her a look of profound gratitude, and took the tiny child in his big hands. He could feel the baby's heartbeat through the blanket in which it was wrapped. The material was fine. He wondered briefly where the monks had got such soft wool. He held the baby to his chest and rocked. His technique was not as good as Ellen's, and the child started to cry again. But Tom did not mind. That loud, insistent yell was music to his ears, for it meant that the child he had abandoned was fit and strong. Hard though it was, he felt he had made the right decision in leaving the baby at the monastery. Ellen asked Johnny, "Where does he sleep?" Johnny answered for himself this time. "He has a crib in the dormitory with the rest of us." "He must wake you all in the night." "We get up at midnight anyway for matins," Johnny said. "Of course. I was forgetting that monks' nights are as sleepless as mothers." Cuthbert handed Johnny the jug of milk. Johnny took the baby from Tom with a practiced, one-armed movement. Tom was not ready to give the baby up, but in the monk's eyes he had no rights at all, so he had to let him go. A moment later Johnny and the baby were gone, and Tom had to resist the impulse to go after them and say, "Wait, stop, that's my son, give him back to me." Ellen stood beside him and squeezed his arm in a discreet gesture of sympathy. Tom realized he had new reason to hope. If he could get work here, he could see baby Jonathan all the time, and it would be almost as if he had never abandoned him. It seemed almost too good to be true, and he did not dare to wish for it. Cuthbert was looking shrewdly at Martha and Jack, who had both gone big-eyed at the sight of the jug full of creamy milk that Johnny had taken away. "Would the children like some milk?" he asked. "Yes, please, Father, they would," Tom said. He would have liked some himself. Cuthbert ladled milk into 2 wooden bowls and gave them to Martha and Jack. They both drank quickly, leaving big white rings around their mouths. "Some more?" Cuthbert offered. "Yes, please," they replied in unison. Tom looked at Ellen, knowing that she must feel as he did, deeply thankful to see the little ones fed at last. As Cuthbert refilled the bowls, he said casually, "Where have you folks come from?" "Earl's Castle near Shiring," said Tom. "We left there yesterday morning." "Have you eaten since?" "No," Tom said flatly. He knew that Cuthbert's inquiry was kindly, but he hated to admit that he had been unable to feed his children himself. "Have some apples to keep you going until supper time, then," Cuthbert said, pointing to the barrel near the door. Alfred, Ellen, and Tom went to the barrel, while Martha and Jack were drinking their 2nd bowl of milk. Alfred tried to fill his arms with apples. Tom smacked them out of his hands and said, in a low voice, "Just take 2 or 3. He took 3. Tom ate his apples gratefully, and his belly felt a little better, but he could not help wondering how soon supper would be served. Monks generally ate before dark to save candles, he recalled happily. Cuthbert was looking hard at Ellen. "Do I know you?" he said eventually. She looked uneasy. "I don't think so." "You seem familiar," he said uncertainly. "I used to live near here as a child," she said. "That would be it," he said. "That's why I have this feeling that you look older than you should. You must have a very good memory." He frowned at her. "Not quite good enough," he said. "I'm sure there's something else." "No matter. Why did you leave Earl's Castle?" "It was attacked yesterday at dawn and taken," Tom replied. "Earl Bartholomew is accused of treason." Cuthbert was shocked. "Saints preserve us," he exclaimed, and suddenly he looked like an old maid frightened by a bull. "Treason!" There was a footstep outside. Tom turned and saw another monk walk in. Cuthbert said, "This is our new prior." Tom recognized the prior. It was Philip, the monk they had met on their way to the bishop's palace, the one who had given them the delicious cheese. Now everything fell into place. The new prior of Kingsbridge was the old prior of the little cell in the forest, and he had brought Jonathan with him when he came here. Tom's heart leaped with optimism. Philip was a kindly man, and he had seemed to like and trust Tom. Surely he would give him a job. Philip recognized him. "Hello, Master Builder," he said. "You didn't get much work at the Bishop's Palace, then?" "No, Father. The Archdeacon wouldn't hire me, and the Bishop wasn't there." "Indeed he wasn't. He was in heaven, though we didn't know it at the time." "The Bishop is dead."
"Yes. That's old news," Cuthbert butted in impatiently. "Tom and his family have just come from Earl's Castle. Earl Bartholomew has been captured and his castle overrun."
Philip was very still. "Already," he murmured.
"Already?" Cuthbert repeated. "Why do you say already?"
He seemed fond of Philip, but wary of him, like a father whose son has been away to war, and has come home with a sword in his belt, and a slightly dangerous look in his eye.
"Did you know this was going to happen?"
Philip was slightly flustered. "No, not exactly," he said uncertainly. "I had heard a rumour that Earl Bartholomew was opposed to King Stephen." He recovered his composure. "We can all be thankful for this," he announced. "Stephen has promised to protect the church, whereas Maud might have oppressed us as much as her late father did. Yes, indeed. This is good news." He looked as pleased as if he had done it himself. Tom did not want to talk about Earl Bartholomew. "It isn't good news for me," he said. "The Earl had hired me the day before to strengthen the castle's defences. I didn't even get a single day's pay."
"What a shame," said Philip.
"Who was it that attacked the castle?"
"Lord Percy Hamley."
"Ah."
Philip nodded, and once again Tom felt his news was only confirming Philip's expectations.
"You're making some improvements here, then," Tom said, trying to bring the subject around to his own interest.
"I'm trying," Philip said.
"You'll want to rebuild the tower, I'm sure."
"Rebuild the tower, repair the roof, pave the floor?"
"Yes, I want to do all of that."
"And you want the job, of course," he added, apparently having just realized why Tom was here.
"I wasn't thinking. I wish I could hire you. But I couldn't pay you, I'm afraid. This monastery is penniless."
Tom felt as if he had been struck by a fist. He had been confident of getting work here. Everything had pointed to it. He could hardly believe his ears. He stared at Philip. It really was not credible that the priory had no money. The cellarer had said it was monks doing all the extra work. But even so, a monastery could always borrow money from the Jews. Tom felt as if this were the end of the road for him. Whatever it was that had kept him going all winter now seemed to drain out of him, and he felt weak and spineless.
"I can't go on," he thought. "I'm finished."
Philip saw his distress. "I can offer you supper and a place to sleep, and some breakfast in the morning," he said. Tom felt bitterly angry.
"I'll accept it," he said, "but I'd rather earn it."
Philip raised his eyebrows at the note of anger, but he spoke mildly.
"Ask God. That's not begging, it's prayer."
Then he went out. The others looked a little scared, and Tom realized that his anger must be showing. Their staring at him annoyed him. He went out of the storeroom a few steps behind Philip, and stood in the courtyard looking at the big old church, trying to control his feelings. After a moment, Ellen and the children followed him out. Ellen put her arm around his waist in a comforting gesture, which made the novices whisper and nudge one another. Tom ignored them.
"I'll pray," he said sourly. "I'll pray for a thunderbolt to strike the church and level it to the ground."
In the last 2 days, Jack had learned to fear the future. During his short life, he had never had to think farther ahead than tomorrow. But if he had, he would have known what to expect. One day was much like another in the forest, and the seasons changed slowly. Now he did not know from day to day where he would be, what he would do, or whether he would eat. The worst part of it was feeling hungry. Jack had been secretly eating grass and leaves to try to ease the pangs, but they gave him a different kind of stomachache and made him feel peculiar.
Martha often cried because she was so hungry. Jack and Martha always walked together. She looked up to him, and nobody had ever done that before. Being helpless to relieve her suffering was worse than his own hunger. If they had still been living in the cave, he would have known where to go to kill ducks or find nuts or steal eggs. But in towns and villages and on the unfamiliar roads between them, he was at a loss. All he knew was that Tom had to find work. They spent the afternoon in the guest house. It was a simple one-room building with a dirt floor and a fireplace in the middle, exactly like the houses peasants lived in, but Jack, who had always lived in a cave, thought it was marvelous. He was curious about how the house was made, and Tom told him. Two young trees had been chopped down, trimmed, and leaned against one another at an angle. Then two more had been placed in the same way at 4 yards distance, and the two triangles thus formed were linked at their tops by a ridgepole. Parallel with the ridgepole, light slats were fixed, joining the trees, forming a sloping roof that reached to the ground. Rectangular frames of woven reeds, called hurdles, were laid over the slats and made waterproof with mud. The gable ends were made of stakes driven into the ground, the chinks between them filled with mud. There was a door in one gable end. There were no windows. Jack's mother spread fresh straw on the floor, and Jack lit a fire with the flint he always carried. When the others were out of earshot, he asked Mother why the prior would not hire Tom when there was obviously work to be done. "It seems he would rather save his money, so long as the church is still usable," she said. "If the whole church had fallen down, they would be forced to rebuild it. But as it's just the tower, they can live with the damage." When the daylight began to soften into dusk, a kitchen hand came to the guest house with a cauldron of pottage and a loaf as long as a man is tall, all just for them. The pottage was made with vegetables and herbs and meat bones, and its surface glistened with fat. The loaf was horse bread, made with all kinds of grain, rye and barley and oats, plus dried peas and beans. It was the cheapest bread, Alfred said, but to Jack, who had never eaten bread until a few days ago, it was delicious. Jack ate until his belly ached. Alfred ate until there was nothing left. As they sat by the fire, trying to digest their feast, Jack said to Alfred, "Why did the tower fall down anyway?" "Probably it was struck by lightning," said Alfred, "or there might have been a fire." "But there's nothing to burn," Jack said. "It's all made of stone." "The roof isn't stone, stupid," Alfred said scornfully. "The roof is made of wood." Jack thought about that for a moment. "And if the roof burns, does the building always fall down?" Alfred shrugged. "Sometimes." They sat in silence for a while. Tom and Jack's mother were talking in low voices on the other side of the fireplace. Jack said, "It's funny about that baby." "What's funny?" Alfred said after a moment. "Well, your baby was lost in the forest miles away, and now here's a baby at the Priory." Neither Alfred nor Martha seemed to think the coincidence very remarkable, and Jack promptly forgot about it. The monks all went to bed immediately after supper, and they did not provide candles for the humbler sort of guests. So Tom's family sat and looked at the fire until it went out, then lay down on the straw. Jack stayed awake, thinking. It had occurred to him that if the cathedral were to burn down tonight, all their problems would be solved. The prior would hire Tom to rebuild the church. They would all live here in this fine house, and they would have meat, bone, pottage, and horse bread forever and ever. "If I were Tom," he thought, "I'd set fire to the church myself. I'd get up quietly while everyone else was sleeping, and sneak into the church, and start a fire with my flint, then creep back here while it was spreading and pretend to be asleep when the alarm was raised. And when the people started throwing buckets of water on the flames, as they did when the stables burned at Earl Bartholomew's castle, I'd join in with them, as if I wanted to put the fire out just as much as they did." Alfred and Martha were asleep. Jack could tell by their breathing. Tom and Ellen did what they usually did under Tom's cloak. Alfred said it was called fucking.
Then they, too, fell asleep. It seemed that Tom was not going to get up and set fire to the cathedral. But what was he going to do? Would the family walk the roads until they starved to death? When they were all asleep, and he could hear the four of them breathing in the slow, regular rhythm that indicated deep slumber, it occurred to Jack that he could set the cathedral on fire. The thought made his heart race with fear. He would have to get up very quietly. He could probably unbar the door and slip out without waking anyone. The church doors might be locked, but there would surely be a way to get in, especially for someone small. Once inside, he knew how he would reach the roof. He had learned a lot in 2 weeks with Tom. Tom talked about buildings all the time, mostly addressing his remarks to Alfred, and although Alfred was not interested, Jack was. He had found out, among other things, that all large churches had staircases built into the walls to give access to the higher parts for repair work. He would find a staircase and climb up to the roof. He sat up in the dark, listening to the breathing of the others. He could distinguish Tom's by its slightly chesty wheeze, caused, Mother said, by years of inhaling stone dust. Alfred snored once, loudly, then turned over and was silent again. Once he had set the fire, he would have to get back to the guest house quickly. What would the monks do if they caught him? In Shiring, Jack had seen a boy of his own age tied up and flogged for stealing a cone of sugar from a spice shop. The boy had screamed and the springy switch had made his bottom bleed. It had seemed much worse than men killing one another in a battle as they had at Earl's Castle, and the vision of the bleeding boy had haunted Jack. He was terrified of the same happening to him. If I do this, he thought, I'll never tell a soul. He lay down again, pulled his cloak around him and closed his eyes. He wondered if the church door was locked. If it was, he could get in through the windows. Nobody would see him if he stayed on the north side of the close. The monk's dormitory was south of the church, masked by the cloisters, and there was nothing on this side except the graveyard. He decided just to go and have a look, to see if it was possible. He hesitated a moment longer, then he stood up. The new straw crunched under his feet. He listened again to the breathing of the four sleeping people. It was very silent. The mice had stopped moving in the straw. He took a step and listened again. The others slept on. He lost patience and took 3 rapid steps to the door. When he stopped, the mice had decided they had nothing to fear and started scrabbling again, but the people slept on. He touched the door with his fingertips, then ran his hands down to the bar. It was an oak beam resting in paired brackets. He got his hands under it, gripped, and lifted. It was heavier than he had expected, and after lifting it less than an inch, he had to drop it. The thud it made when it hit the bracket sounded very loud. He froze, listening. Tom's wheezy breathing faltered. What will I say if I'm caught? Thought Jack desperately. I'll say I was going outside. Going outside. I know. I'll say I was going to relieve myself. He relaxed now that he had an excuse. He heard Tom turn over and waited for the deep, dusty voice, but it did not come, and Tom began to breathe evenly again. The edges of the door were outlined with ghostly silver. There must be a moon, Jack thought. He gripped the bar again, took a deep breath, and strained to lift it. This time he was ready for its weight. He raised it and pulled it toward himself, but he had not lifted it high enough, and it failed to clear the brackets. He raised it an inch more, and it came free. He held it against his chest, relieving the strain on his arms a little. Then he slowly went down on one knee, then on both, and lowered the bar to the floor. He stayed in that position for a few moments, trying to quiet his breathing, while the ache in his arms eased. There was no sound from the others except the noises of sleep. Gingerly, Jack opened the door a crack. Its iron hinge squeaked, and a cold draft came through the opening. He shivered. He wrapped his cloak closer around him and opened the door a little more. He slipped out and closed it behind him. The cloud was breaking up, and the moon came and went in the restless sky. There was a cold wind. Jack was momentarily tempted to return to the stuffy warmth of the house. The enormous church with its fallen tower loomed over the rest of the priory, silver and black in the moonlight, its mighty walls and tiny windows making it look more like a castle. It was ugly. All was quiet. Outside the priory walls in the village there might be a few people sitting up late, drinking ale by the glow of the fireside or sewing by rushlights, but here nothing moved. Still Jack hesitated, looking at the church. It looked back at him accusingly, as if it knew what was on his mind. He shook off the spooky feeling with a shrug, and walked across the broad green to the west end. The door was locked. He walked around to the north side and looked at the cathedral windows. Some church windows had lengths of translucent linen stretched across them to keep out the cold, but these seemed to have nothing. They were big enough for him to crawl through, but they were too high to reach. He explored the stonework with his fingers, feeling the cracks in the wall where the mortar had worn away, but they were not big enough to give him toeholds. He needed something to use as a ladder. He considered fetching stones from the fallen tower and constructing an improvised staircase, but the unbroken stones were too heavy, and the broken ones were too uneven. He had a feeling that he had seen something during the course of the day that would serve his purpose exactly, and he racked his brains to remember it. It was like trying to see something out of the corner of his eye. It always remained just out of sight. Then he glanced across the moonlit graveyard to the stable, and it came back to him. A little wooden mounting block with two or three steps to help short people climb on large horses. One of the monks had been standing on it to comb a horse's mane. He made his way across to the stable. It was the kind of thing that might not get put away at night, since it was hardly worth stealing. He walked quietly, but the horses heard him all the same, and one or two of them snorted and coughed. He stopped, frightened. There might be grooms sleeping in the stable. He stood still for a moment, listening for the sound of human movement, but none came, and the horses went quiet. He could not see the mounting block. Perhaps it was up against the wall. Jack peered into the moon shadows. It was hard to see anything. Cautiously, he went right up to the stable and walked along its length. The horses heard him again, and now his closeness made them nervous. One of them whinnied. Jack froze. A man's voice called out, "Quiet, quiet." As he stood there like a scared statue, he saw the mounting block right under his nose, so close that he would have fallen over it with one more step. He waited a few moments. There was no more noise from the stable. He bent down, picked it up, and hefted it on his shoulder. He turned around and padded back across the grass to the church. The stable was quiet. When he climbed to the top step of the block, he was still not high enough to reach the windows. It was irritating. He could not even look in. He had not finally made up his mind to do the deed, but he did not want to be prevented by practical considerations. He wanted to decide for himself. He wished he were as tall as Alfred. There was one more thing to try. He stood back, took a short run, jumped one-footed onto the block, then sprang up. He reached the windowsill easily and got a grip on the stone frame. With a jerk, he pulled himself up until he could half sit on the sill. But when he tried to crawl through the opening, he had a surprise. The window was blocked by iron latticework, which he had not seen from outside, presumably because it was black. Jack examined it with both hands, kneeling on the sill. There was no way through. It was probably there specifically to prevent people from getting in when the church was shut. Disappointed, he jumped down to the ground. He picked up the mounting block and carried it back to where he had found it. This time the horses made no noise. He looked at the fallen northwest tower on the left-hand side of the main door. He climbed carefully over the stones at the edge of the heap, peering toward the interior of the church, looking for a way through the rubble. When the moon went behind a cloud, he waited, shivering, for it to come out again. He was worried that his weight, small though it was, might shift the balance of the stones and cause a landslide, which would wake everyone even if it did not kill him. As the moon reappeared, he scanned the pile and decided to risk it. He began to ascend, with his heart in his mouth. Most of the stones were firm, but one or two wobbled precariously under his weight. It was the kind of climb he would have enjoyed in daylight, with help near at hand and nothing on his conscience. But now he was too anxious, and his normal sure-footedness left him. He slipped on a smooth surface and almost fell down. And there he decided to stop. He was high enough to look down on the roof of the aisle that ran along the north side of the nave. He was hoping that there might be a hole in the roof, or perhaps a gap between the roof and the pile of rubble. But it was not so. The roof continued unbroken into the ruins of the tower, and there appeared to be nowhere to slip through. Jack was half disappointed and half relieved. He climbed down again, backward, looking over his shoulder to find a foothold. The closer he got to the ground, the better he felt. He jumped the last few feet and landed gratefully on the grass. He returned to the north side of the church and walked on around. He had seen several churches in the last 2 weeks, and all of them were roughly the same shape. The largest part was the nave, which was always to the west. Then there were two arms, which Tom called transepts, sticking out to the north and south. The east end was called the chancel, and it was shorter than the nave. Kingsbridge was individual only in that its west end had two towers, one on each side of the entrance, as it were, to match the transepts. There was a door in the north transept. Jack tried it and found it locked. He walked on around the east end. No door there at all. He paused to look across the grassed courtyard. In the far southeast corner of the priory close there were two houses, the infirmary and the prior's house. Both were dark and silent. He went on around the east end and along the south side of the chancel until he came to the out-jutting south transept. At the end of the transept, like a hand on an arm, was the round building they called the chapter house. Between the transept and the chapter house was a narrow alley leading into the cloisters. Jack went through the alley. He found himself in a square quadrangle with a lawn in the middle and a covered walkway all around. The pale stone of the arches was ghostly white in the moonlight, and the shadowed walkway was impenetrably dark. Jack waited a moment to let his eyes adjust. He had emerged onto the east side of the square. To his left he could make out the door to the chapter house. Farther to his left, at the southern end of the east walk, he could see, facing him, another door, which he thought probably led to the monk's dormitory. To his right, another door led into the south transept of the church. He tried it. It was locked. He went along the north walk. There he found a door leading into the nave of the church. It, too, was locked. On the west walk, there was nothing, until he came to the southwest corner where he found the door to the refectory. What a lot of food had to be found, he thought, to feed all those monks every day. Nearby was a fountain with a basin. The monks washed their hands before meals. He continued along the south walk. Halfway along there was an arch. Jack turned through it and found himself in a little passage with the refectory on his right and the dormitory on his left. He imagined all the monks fast asleep on the floor, just the other side of the stone wall. At the end of the passage there was nothing but a muddy slope leading down to the river. Jack stood there for a moment, looking at the water 100 yards away. For no particular reason he remembered a story about a knight who had his head cut off but lived on, and involuntarily he imagined the headless knight coming out of the river and walking up the slope toward him. There was nothing there, but still he was scared. He turned around and hurried back to the cloisters. He felt safer there. He hesitated under the arch, looking into the moonlit quadrangle. There must be a way to sneak into such a big building, he felt, but he could not think where else to look. In a way, he was glad. He had been contemplating doing something appallingly dangerous, and if it turned out to be impossible, so much the better. On the other hand, he dreaded the thought of leaving this priory and taking to the road again in the morning. The endless walking, the hunger, Tom's disappointment and anger, Martha's tears. It could all be avoided, just by one little spark from the flint he carried in the little pouch hanging from his belt. Something moved at the corner of his vision. He started, and his heart beat faster. He turned his head and saw, to his horror, a ghostly figure carrying a candle, gliding silently along the east walk toward the church. A scream rose in his throat and he fought it down. Another figure followed the first. Jack stepped back into the archway out of sight and put his fist in his mouth, biting his skin to stop himself from crying aloud. He heard an eerie moaning sound. He stared in sheer terror. Then realization dawned. What he was seeing was a procession of monks going from the dormitory to the church for the midnight service, singing a hymn as they went. The panicky feeling persisted for a moment, even when he had understood what he was looking at. Then relief washed over him, and he began to shake uncontrollably. The monk at the head of the procession unlocked the door to the church with a huge iron key. The monks filed in. No one turned around to look in Jack's direction. Most of them appeared to be half asleep. They did not close the church door behind them. When he had recovered his composure, Jack realized that now he could get into the church. His legs felt too weak to walk. "I could just go in," he thought. "I don't have to do anything when I'm inside. I'll look and see whether it is possible to get up to the roof. I might not set fire to it. I'll just take a look." He took a deep breath, then stepped out of the archway and padded across the quadrangle. He hesitated at the open door and peeped in. There were candles on the altar, and in the choir where the monks stood in their stalls, but the light merely made small pools in the middle of the big empty space, leaving the walls and the aisles in deep gloom. One of the monks was doing something incomprehensible at the altar, and the others would occasionally chant a few phrases of mumbo-jumbo. It seemed incredible to Jack that people should get up out of warm beds in the middle of the night to do something like this. He slipped through the door and stood close to the wall. He was inside. The darkness concealed him. However, he could not stay right there, for they would see him on their way out. He sidled farther in. The flickering candles threw restless shadows. The monk at the altar might have seen Jack if he had looked up, but he seemed completely absorbed in what he was doing. Jack moved quickly from the cover of one mighty pillar to the next, pausing in between so that his movements would be irregular, like the shifting of the shadows. The light became brighter as he neared the crossing. He was afraid the monk at the altar would look up suddenly, see him, bound across to the transept, pick him up by the scruff of the neck. He reached the corner and turned gratefully into the deeper shadows of the nave. He paused for a moment, feeling relieved. Then he retreated along the aisle toward the west end of the church, still pausing irregularly, as he would if he were stalking a deer. When he was in the farthest, darkest part of the church, he sat down on the plinth of a column to wait for the service to end. He put his chin down inside his cloak and breathed on his chest to warm himself. His life had changed so much in the last 2 weeks, that it seemed years ago that he had lived contentedly in the forest with his mother. He knew he would never feel as safe again. Now that he knew about hunger and cold and danger and desperation, he would always be afraid of them. He peeped around the pillar. Above the altar where the candles were brightest, he could just make out the high wooden ceiling. Newer churches had stone vaults, he knew, but Kingsbridge was old. That wooden ceiling would burn well. "I'm not going to do it," he thought. Tom would be so happy if the cathedral burned down. Jack was not sure he liked Tom. He was too forceful, commanding, and harsh. Jack was used to his mother's milder ways. But Jack was impressed by Tom, even awestruck. The only other men Jack had come across were outlaws— dangerous, brutish men who respected only violence and cunning, men for whom the ultimate achievement was to knife someone in the back. Tom was a new type of being, proud and fearless, even without a weapon. Jack would never forget the way Tom had faced up to William Hamley, the time when Lord William had offered to buy Mother for a pound. What struck Jack so vividly was that Lord William had been scared. Jack told his mother that he had never imagined a man could be as brave as Tom was, and she said, "That was why we had to leave the forest. You need a man to look up to." Jack was puzzled by that remark, but it was true that he would like to do something to impress Tom. Setting fire to the cathedral was not the thing, though. It would be better if nobody knew about that, at least not for many years. But perhaps a day would come when Jack would say to Tom, "You remember the night Kingsbridge Cathedral burnt down, and the prior hired you to rebuild it, and we all had food and shelter and security at last? Well, I've got something to tell you about how that fire started." What a great moment that would be. "But I don't dare do it," he thought. The singing stopped, and there was a scuffling sound as the monks left their places. The service was over. Jack shifted his position to stay out of sight while they filed out. They snuffed the candles in the choir stalls as they went, but they left one burning on the altar. The door banged shut. Jack waited a little longer, in case there was still someone inside. There was no sound for a long time. At last he came out from behind his pillar. He walked up the nave. It was an odd feeling to be alone in this big, cold, empty building. "This is what it must be like to be a mouse," he thought, "hiding in corners when the big people are around, and then coming out when they have gone." He reached the altar and took the fat, bright candle, and that made him feel better. Carrying the candle, he began to inspect the inside of the church. At the corner where the nave met the south transept, the place where he had most feared being spotted by the monk at the altar, there was a door in the wall with a simple latch. He tried the latch. The door opened. His candle revealed a spiral staircase, so narrow that a fat man could not have passed through it, so low that Tom would have had to bend double. He went up the steps. He emerged in a narrow gallery. On one side, a row of small arches looked out into the nave. The ceiling sloped from the tops of the arches down to the floor on the other side. The floor itself was not flat, but curved down at either side. It took Jack a moment to realize where he was. He was above the aisle on the south side of the nave. The tunnel-vaulted ceiling of the aisle was the curved floor on which Jack was standing. From the outside of the church, the aisle could be seen to have a lean-to roof, and that was the sloping ceiling under which Jack was standing. The aisle was much lower than the nave, so he was still a long way from the main roof of the building. He walked west along the gallery, exploring. It was quite thrilling, now that the monks had gone and he was no longer in fear of being spotted. It was as if he had climbed a tree and found that, at the very top, hidden from view by the lower branches, all the trees were connected and you could walk around in a secret world a few feet above the earth. At the end of the gallery was another small door. He went through it, and found himself on the inside of the southwest tower, the one that had not fallen down. The space he was in was obviously not meant to be seen, for it was rough and unfinished, and instead of a floor, there were rafters with wide gaps between them. However, around the inside of the wall ran a flight of wooden steps, a staircase without a handrail. Jack went up. Halfway up one wall was a small arched opening. The staircase passed right by it. Jack put his head inside and held up his candle. He was in the roof space above the timber ceiling and below the lead roof. At first, he could see no pattern in the tangle of wooden beams, but after a moment he perceived the structure. Huge oak timbers, each of them a foot wide and 2 feet deep, spanned the width of the nave from north to south. Above each beam were two mighty rafters forming a triangle. The regular row of triangles stretched away beyond the light of the candle. Looking down between the beams, he could see the back of the painted wooden ceiling of the nave, which was fixed to the lower edges of the crossbeams. At the edge of the roof space, in the corner at the base of the triangle, was a catwalk. Jack crawled through the little opening and onto the catwalk. There was just enough headroom for him to stand up. A man would have had to stoop. He walked along it a little way. There was enough timber here for a conflagration. He sniffed, trying to identify the odd smell in the air. He decided it was pitch. The roof timbers were tarred. They would burn like straw. A sudden movement on the floor startled him and made his heart race. He thought of the headless knight in the river and the ghostly monks in the cloisters. Then he thought of mice and felt better. But when he looked carefully, he saw that it was birds. There were nests under the eaves. The roof space followed the pattern of the church below, branching out over the transepts. Jack went as far as the crossing and stood at the corner. He realized he must be directly above the little spiral staircase that had brought him from ground level up to the gallery. If he had been planning to start a fire, this was where he would do it. From here it could spread four ways: west along the nave, south along the south transept, and through the crossing to the chancel and the north transept. The main timbers of the roof were made of heart of oak, and although they were tarred, they might not catch fire from a candle flame. However, under the eaves was a litter of ancient wood chips and shavings, discarded bits of rope and sacking, and abandoned birds' nests, which would make perfect kindling. All he would have to do would be to collect it and pile it up. His candle was burning low. It seemed so easy. Collect up the litter, touch the candle flame to it, and leave. Cross the close like a ghost, slip into the guest house, bar the door, curl up in the straw, and wait for the alarm. But if he was seen... If he should be caught now, he could say he was harmlessly exploring the cathedral, and he would suffer no worse than a spanking. But if they caught him setting fire to the church, they would do more than spank him. He remembered the sugar thief in Shiring, and the way his bottom bled. He recalled some of the punishments the outlaws had suffered. Farad Openmouth had had his lips cut off. Jack Flathat had lost his hand. And Alan Catface had been put in the stocks and stoned, and had never been able to talk properly since. Even worse were the stories of those who had not survived their punishments. A murderer who had been tied to a barrel studded with spikes and then rolled downhill so that all the spikes went through his body. A horse thief who had been burned alive. A thieving whore who had been impaled on a pointed stake. What would they do to a boy who set fire to a church? Thoughtfully, he began to collect the inflammable rubbish from under the eaves and pile it up on the catwalk, exactly below one of the mighty rafters. When he had a pile a foot high, he sat down and looked at it. His candle guttered. In a few moments he would have lost his chance. With a quick motion he touched the candle flame to a piece of sacking. It caught fire. The flame spread immediately to some wood shavings, then a dried, crumbling bird's nest, and then the little fire was blazing cheerfully. I could still put it out, Jack thought. The kindling was burning a little too quickly. At this rate, it would be used up before the roof timber began to smoulder. Jack hurriedly collected more rubbish and piled it on. The flames rose higher. I could still put it out, he thought. The pitch with which the beam was coated began to blacken and smoke. The rubbish burned up. I could just let the fire go out now, he thought. Then he saw that the catwalk itself was burning. I could probably smother the fire with my cloak still, he thought. Instead, he threw more litter onto the fire and watched it burn higher. The atmosphere became hot and smoky in the little angle of the eaves, even though the freezing night air was only an inch away on the other side of the roof. Some of the smaller timbers to which the lead sheets of the roof were nailed began to burn. Then, at last, a small flame flickered up from the massive main beam. The cathedral was on fire. It was done now. There was no turning back. Jack felt scared. Suddenly he wanted to get out fast and return to the guest house. He wanted to be rolled up in his cloak, nestling in a little hollow in the straw, with his eyes shut tight and the others breathing evenly all around him. He retreated along the catwalk. When he reached the end, he looked back. The fire was spreading surprisingly quickly, perhaps because of the pitch with which the wood was coated. All the small timbers were ablaze, the main beams were beginning to burn, and the fire was spreading along the catwalk. Jack turned his back on it. He ducked into the tower and went down the stairs, then ran along the gallery over the aisle and hurried down the spiral staircase to the floor of the nave. He ran to the door by which he had come in. It was locked. he realized he had been stupid. The monks had unlocked the door when they came in, so of course they had locked it again as they left. Fear rose in his throat like bile. He had set the church on fire, and now he was locked inside. He fought down panic and tried to think. He had tried every door from the outside, and found them all locked. But perhaps some of them were fastened with bars rather than locks, so that they could be opened from the inside. He hurried across the crossing to the north transept and examined the door in the north porch. It had a lock. He ran down the dark nave to the west end and tried each of the great public entrances. All three doors were locked with keys. Finally, he tried the little door that led into the south aisle from the north walk of the cloister square. That, too, was locked. Jack wanted to cry, but that would do no good. He looked up at the wooden ceiling. Was it his imagination, or could he see, by the faint moonlight, a little smoke drifting out from the ceiling near the corner of the south transept? He thought, what am I going to do? Would the monks wake up and come rushing in to put out the fire, in such a panic that they hardly noticed one small boy slipping out through the door? Or would they see him immediately and grab him, screaming accusations? Or would they stay asleep, all unconscious, until the whole building had collapsed and Jack lay crushed under a huge pile of stones? Tears came to his eyes, and he wished he had never touched the candle flame to that pile of litter. He looked around wildly. If he went to a window and screamed, would anybody hear? There was a crash from above. He looked up and saw that a hole had appeared in the wooden ceiling, where a beam had fallen and poked through. The hole appeared as a patch of red on a black background. A moment later there was another crash, and a huge timber smashed right through the ceiling and fell, turning over once in the air to hit the ground with a thump that shook the mighty columns of the nave. A shower of sparks and burning embers drifted down after it. Jack listened, waiting for shouts, cries for help, or the ringing of a bell. But nothing happened. The crash had not been heard, and if that had not awakened them, they certainly would not hear him screaming. I'm going to die here, he thought hysterically. I'm going to burn or be crushed unless I can think of a way out. He thought of the fallen tower. He had examined it from the outside, and he had not seen a way in. But then he had been timid, for fear of falling and causing a landslide. Perhaps if he looked again from the inside this time, he would see something he had missed, and perhaps desperation would help him squeeze through where before he had seen no gap. He ran to the west end. The glow of the fire coming through the hole in the ceiling, combined with the flames licking up from the beam that had fallen to the floor of the nave, now gave a stronger light than the moon, and the arcade of the nave was edged with gold instead of silver. Jack examined the pile of stones that had once been the northwest tower. They appeared to form a solid wall. There was no way through. Foolishly, he opened his mouth and yelled, "Mother!" at the top of his voice, even though he knew she could not hear. He fought down his panic once again. There was something in the back of his mind about this collapsed tower. He had been able to get inside the other tower, the one that was still standing, by going along the gallery over the south aisle. If he now went along the gallery over the north aisle, he might see a gap in this pile of rubble, a gap that was not visible from ground level. He ran back to the crossing, staying under the shelter of the north aisle in case more burning beams should come crashing through the ceiling. There should be a little door and a spiral staircase on this side, just as there was on the other. He came to the corner of the nave and the north transept. He could not see the door. He looked around the corner. It was not on the other side either. He could not believe his bad luck. It was crazy. There had to be a way into the gallery. He thought hard, fighting to stay calm. There was a way into the fallen tower. He just had to find it. I could get back into the roof space via the good southwest tower, he thought. I could cross to the other side of the roof space. There should be a little opening on that side, giving access to the collapsed northwest tower. That may provide me with a way out. He looked up at the ceiling fearfully. The fire would now be an inferno. But he could not think of any alternative. First, he had to cross the nave. He looked up again. As far as he could tell, there was nothing about to come down immediately. He took a deep breath and dashed across to the other side. Nothing fell on him. In the south aisle, he pulled open the little door and ran up the spiral staircase. When he reached the top and stepped into the gallery, he could feel the warmth of the fire above. He ran along the gallery, went through the door into the good tower, and raced up the stairs. He ducked his head and crawled through the little arch into the roof space. It was full of smoke and heat. All the uppermost timbers were ablaze, and at the far end the biggest beams were burning strongly. The tarry smell made Jack cough. He hesitated only a moment, then stepped onto one of the big beams that spanned the nave and began to walk across. In moments he was wet with perspiration because of the heat, and his eyes began to water so that he could hardly see where he was going. He coughed, and then his foot slipped off the beam and he stumbled sideways. He fell with one foot on the beam and one foot off. His right foot landed on the ceiling, and to his horror it went straight through the rotten wood. A picture flashed into his mind of the height of the nave and how far he would drop if he fell right through the ceiling, and he screamed as he tumbled forward, putting his arms out in front of him, imagining himself turning over and over in the air as the falling beam had done. But the wood held his weight. He remained frozen still, shocked, resting on his hands and one knee, with the other leg sticking through the ceiling. Then the fierce heat of the fire brought him out of his shock. Gently he extracted his foot from the hole. He got on his hands and knees and crawled forward. As he neared the other side, several large beams fell into the nave. The whole building seemed to shake, and the beam under Jack quivered like a bowstring. He stopped and held on tight. The tremor passed. He crawled on, and a moment later he reached the catwalk on the north side. If his guess turned out to be wrong, and there was no opening from here into the ruins of the Northwest Tower, he would have to go back. As he stood upright, he got a breath of cold night air. There must be some kind of gap. But would it be big enough for a small boy? He took 3 paces to the west and stopped an instant before he would have stepped out into nothingness. He found himself looking through a large hole out onto the moonlit ruins of the fallen tower. His knees went weak with relief. He was out of the inferno. But he was high up at roof level, and the top of the rubble pile was a long way below him, too far to jump. He could escape the flames now, but could he reach the ground without breaking his neck? Behind him the flames were rapidly coming closer, and smoke was billowing out of the opening in which he stood. This tower had once had a staircase around its inner wall, just as the other one still did, but most of this staircase had been destroyed in the collapse. However, where the wooden treads had been set into the wall with mortar, there were stumps of wood sticking out, sometimes just an inch or two long, sometimes more. Jack wondered whether he could climb down the stumps. It would be a precarious descent. He noticed a smell of scorching. His cloak was getting hot. In a moment it would catch fire. He had no choice. He sat down, reached out for the nearest stump, held on with both hands, then eased one leg down until he found a foothold. Then he put the other foot down. Feeling his way with his feet, he eased himself down one step. The stumps held. He reached down once again, testing the strength of the next stump before putting his weight on it. This one felt a little loose. He trod gingerly, holding on tightly in case he should find himself swinging by his hands. Each perilous step down brought him nearer to the top of the rubble pile. As he descended, the stumps seemed to get smaller, as if the lower ones had suffered more severe damage. He put one foot in its felt boot on a stump no wider than his toe, and when he rested his weight on it, his foot slipped. His other foot was on a larger stump, but when suddenly he put his full weight on it, the other stump broke. He tried to hold on with his hands, but the stumps were so small that he could not grip hard, and he slipped, terrified, from his precarious perch and fell through the air. He landed hard on his hands and knees on the top of the pile of rubble. For an instant, he was so shocked and frightened he thought he must be dead. Then he realized that he had been lucky enough to fall well. His hands stung, and his knees would be massively bruised, but he was all right. After a moment he climbed down the pile of rubble and jumped the last few feet to the ground. He was safe. He felt weak with relief. He wanted to cry again. He had escaped. He felt proud. What an adventure he had had. But it was not yet over. Out here there was only a whiff of smoke, and the noise of the fire, so deafening inside the roof space, now sounded like a distant wind. Only the reddish glow behind the windows proved that the church was on fire. Nevertheless, those last tremors must have disturbed